Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel McKibbins. Rachel McKibbins is a two-time New York Foundation for the Arts Poetry Fellow and the author of Into the Dark and Emptying Field, Pink Elephant, The Chapbook Mammoth, and her new book entitled Blood, published by Copper Canyon Press. In 2012, she founded the annual Pink Door Writing Retreat, open exclusively to women, femme, trans, non-binary writers of color. She lives in upstate New York. Hi, Rachel. How you doing?
I'm pretty great. How are you?
I'm really great because I'm so excited that you're here and you came from all the way from New York, upstate New York, and you're going to read from your new book.
Absolutely.
Okay.
A brief biography of the poet's mother. There was a child hemorrhaging light, the blue song of her brain, an early maggot writhing. Her mother, a jealous newlywed, with looking glass hands and a tub full of bleach, thieved and thieved until the child became a quiet room, a silence born of interrogated flesh. Girl is the worst season. Mother, no guarantee. No clothes or meat, no heavy breast wrecked with milk. So the blue song became a dirge. Then the dirge became a girl. Poem written with a sawed-off typewriter. Some of us vanish out of habit, guided by some blood orchestral pulse, the delirium chorus of a rowing mind. She was always going. I haven't seen her in 2 decades, and I have felt every year. What's the word for a shadow's shadow? Apparition? Dark twin? Heartless daughter? Sometimes she calls on your birthday, my father says, confused, mouth full of radio wire. God is a signal. The devil, a song. Hey, Ma. How many voices does it take for a schizophrenic to change a light bulb? Wait, I'm sorry. Let me ask an easier question. When you left, did you leave your children half full or half empty? Heretic. If by lineage our children are doomed to orbit this spoiled delirium, flag the creeping world where I was born and have been killed so many times. If the man in white is right, if the weight of this melancholy makes a black hole of me, and the faces I once carried become planets I could no longer name. Tie my hair to the bedposts, tuck their baby teeth beneath my tongue, then cut, cut, cut until my blood becomes a door. Dawson, New Mexico, 1905. Night awakens, or someone's mouth, and out steps blood and marrow in a dress, a long wool thing, dead brass watch on a flat-boned wrist. With a hiss of braids coiled atop her head, an infant girl strapped to her chest, she arrives, as whole as a woman can be. Here she is permitted the soft pleasures of the ordinary, pale grit of masa spread quickly into husks, the calloused edge of her husband's hand. Settling into this foreign kingdom, there is no need to daydream, no chore interrupted. Praise the tender asylum of repetition, dishes cleaned, then stacked, skirts hemmed, floors swept, the New Mexican soil still intact, unmined, still something like a gift. Her healthy daughter, dreaming in milk. Gentle husband, not yet charred. Why then would she notice the crows gathering like germs on her porch, their dark throats chilling the air with a cold death noise? Deeper than dirt. After the poet asked how I would bury my brother. Beyond the carrots and blind white worms, beyond the yellowed bone orchards and corkscrew roots, beyond the center of this churchless earth, beloved Peter, my little sorcerer, brought up dirty and wrong, you deserve more than to be smothered in mud. For all the gravel you were fed, for every bruise and knot that named you, I must plant you in a quiet bed of blood-hot muscle, deliver you into me, so I may carry you as the only mother we have ever known.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel McKibbins. She's reading from her new book, Blood, published by Copper Canyon Press. So we were talking earlier about the primary nature of the mother in this book, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and about maybe how hard it was to get to that place, to write about the mother in the way this book does.
I think that because I carried so much shame around the fact that I was, you know, a motherless girl, I spent a lot of time in my childhood making up reasons why she wasn't around. I said she was an astronaut. I said she was in movies. There was always some spectacular reason for her not being, when in fact, I think the truth was the most spectacular. This was a schizophrenic woman who truly believed that, really wild things, like the devil spoke to me through the radio and all of this stuff. And so around, you know, any of that, and especially talking about mental illness, it's pretty impossible to really figure out a kind of language when you are spending all of your time busy just trying to survive it. And so when it came to finally addressing motherhood, I had to do it in order to speak of my own, to first sort of look back over my shoulder at the absence, which was in itself a kind of, oh, geez, I don't even know what kind of mothering it was, but I mean, there's a kind of nurturing in that absence because you're allowed to sort of create in that void. You're allowed to imagine mothers. I've found mothers all of my life. I've deemed people mothers of mine, you know, my whole existence. I've asked numerous, you know, women and femmes in my life, you know, like, will you be my mother? And I spent a lot of time like that little bird in the cartoon, you know. And it took a long time for me to really kind of sit in the same room as the word mother, first of all, and then to kind of flesh it in a way to where that allowed me to build poems that made this person who had become such a mythological figure for so long an actual human being that was capable of so much terror. Because ordinarily, and especially, and I talked a little bit about this earlier, just, you know, the entire, like, the culture of motherhood, it's all, you know, don't say that about your mother, and but she's your mother. I've heard that my whole life. And so it was time to say, this is who my mother is. Mm-hmm. It was time for me to write that this is who I am the daughter of. Mm-hmm. And then also to address the bloody lineage and all of that, mm-hmm. and what I could pass on to my own children.
Sure. And which takes quite a bit of bravery, as you know, but many writers choose to go the way of artifice or choose to use language and images to, you know, tell lies in their poems as a way to convey truths. And it seems like that's not the path that you've chosen. Am I correct in that? Because as I hear you talk about your work, it seems that you're using language to get closer and closer and closer to whatever is truth to you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think that I finally chose, for me, the proper language that was both, I mean, it's equally dangerous and freeing to have to have finally, I think, given myself all of the permissions that I think only the years of writing could have truly allowed. And to recognize, too, that in writing these, and they're pretty bare, in my opinion, I feel like a lot of the truth kind of had to just be presented as honestly and without any kind of dressing. It's essential, too, though, to allow still the magic of poetry to come into play, which is why near the end of the book, there's a poem where I give birth to my mother. Mm-hmm. And she's extracted from my body. And that's every bit a truthful occurrence as it is, you know, a metaphor. Or, you know, it was really important that this book had enough blood and teeth in it for people to recognize, you know, its humanity. And for me to name things that, again, I had just really avoided. Who wants to admit that they're unwanted? It's a really hard thing, I think. And I've still never written the poem, the most simple poem, I think, about shoving years and years worth of construction paper flowers that were made in May that I was supposed to give to my mother some Sunday, you know, just shoving them into the bushes on the way home. Mm-hmm. And just that, like, it, that to me is was such a violent, sad thing to do. I can talk about an assault. I can talk about all kinds of brutal beatings. But that little simple thing, to me, I still have really, it's like that's one ghost I've yet to really pull the sheet off of.
Okay. Could you read some more?
I sure can. Swell. I've never had a mother, or no longer have, or once did briefly for a day or two. Perhaps she was only mine during the wet crown of hours I spun my skull through her ripe and widening hips, then fastened to her nipple a botched daughter, ugly with hunger. Or maybe it was long before the orphaning, before the womb fell quiet and her brain went sour. Gentle reader, won't you permit me this sweetness? The morning she straddled my father, a black flood of hair, throat open to God, the red muscle of her quickening like the pulse of a dazzled child. Yes, let it be there, in that heat-ravaged moment, as she caught the pale bloom of herself in the mirror, and looking back over her shoulder, fell in love with the animal engine of her body, not for the daughter it could nurture, but for the girl it would kill. Salvage. I have learned to need the body I spent years trying to rid the world of, have learned to cherish its pale rebel hymn, warped by ghost heat, carried by all my loyal dead. I have learned to crawl backward into the wilderness to ask, to eat, to steep in your gentleness. Let this be where I permit forgiveness to know your name, to leave our cruelest years where and how we need them most, behind and unlit. For Carol, who is no one, mother, you lousy walk-on, you muddy old witch, I've become your good daughter, have written you a part big as Mississippi. I have authored you a new womb filled like a gas chamber. Here is your fat mouth brimming with pills. This is no poisoned Apple movie star spell, mother. You still are what you are, a plotting mirror-bitten hag who hobbles the halls like a jilted landlady, babbling on and on about your ghost-skinned girl, your angry daughter, your bad invention. Where did you go for so long? Why did you leave us alone with the woodsmen? Do you know I have 5 dizzy dwarfs of my own? They have heard all the stories. They know your real name. Carol, Carol, we sing knots into your hair. We've built you a castle covered in witches, And if you should come, dear mother, to visit us, we will serenade your face with a choir of hammers, feed you to the river in a dress made of stones. Glutton, you write poems to understand what you cannot understand. Finally, name the snapping beast you've tried to outrun your entire life. Stop avoiding. Stop the scorched fog of language that redirects the eye. Say what you mean. Quit saying better when you mean eviscerated. Lunacy is in your blood. It's a fact. So you do your best to live alongside its snarl. Push and push till you find room in that frantic brain to plant some kind of hope. Your daughter upstairs, practicing the clarinet. This morning's toast, its butter spread all the way to the edge. Small mercies to help empty the beast. Why is it, every time you write or read about your son, the boy who hears voices and voices and voices, he responds, sends a message out of the blue. It makes you worry. Maybe you're on the same frequency. Worry tomorrow, you'll wake up like him, the woman who birthed you. Tiny ghost pulled from a bigger ghost. You know better. Languaging is a conjuring. Lineage, the cruelest coven. Your boy feels you riding him from 3,000 miles away. Perhaps he lives in your head the way your mother lives in your head. Even now, after all these years, you say her name aloud and her hair grows another 3 inches. It's a fact. Your boy begins each message off okay. Hi, Mom. I love and miss you so much. Relief. He's alive. Coherent. Will last a few seconds. A minute tops. Before he starts spilling out a jarring sequence of words that demand you go a little more crazy to understand them. But you refuse. You want to stay here. Don't want to be what he inherited from you. Isn't that the worst thing you've ever written? Boy of your flesh and mottled blood, threatened you and his siblings, promised to kill you, and wrote exactly how. And these were bottomless, devastating moments, yes. But nothing in the world readies you for today's gutting. When you ask if he's okay, is he warm? Does he have anyone to talk to? When you make yourself ask him, do you have any friends? All the swirl and dodge collapses, and he says, simply, no. I don't have any friends. And you want to jump off the bridge upon learning this. Want to chop off your hands. He's small again, first grade, waiting in the office with his head down. The principal is telling you a kid from class was picking on him. She doesn't have to tell you who it was. You know the one, Brad, big husky kid who regularly punches your boy in the back of his head. Oh, if only Madness walked home down Newport Avenue like Brad did that day. If only you could grab Madness by the face and hold it against a chain-link fence a few yards from where a group of teenagers are playing ball. If only you could look Madness in the eye and hiss, you touch my kid again, I will stomp your life out.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Rachel McKibbins. She's reading from her new book, Blood, published by Copper Canyon Press. Rachel, could you talk about permission? You mentioned it before, and especially for our listeners out there who may be struggling with that, I know it's a big issue, especially for women writers. How to get that permission, the years of what to get there, the years of writing, the years of I mean, I know it's not an easy question, but if you could say a few words about it, how you got to this book.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, I think that permission is acquired through so much work, and then also a lot of seeing and listening. It took numerous writers throughout, within the last, I'd say, 15 years, who were willing to, you know, confront so much that it happened to them, that they'd seen, that they'd witnessed, and that they have themselves have had done. And I think that that's one of the more important steps, is to recognize, you know, what you have done, the monstering that you have committed in ways, you know, in order to survive, in order to outlast. And it just, I truly do believe that, you know, survivors, like, we share a kind of kinship that opens doors for each other. The more we tell, the more we, you know, write poetry of witness, testimonials and incantations, if you will. Survivors speak is often something that awakens the survivor in you. And so that's really what it is just being a very good listener and hearing yourself inside of someone else's mouth for a change, and recognizing the need to truly form the right words to live in your own mouth.
And I'm sure part of what you're talking about is reading, you know, reading other writers.
Oh, absolutely.
And women who have written these books many years ago, at a time when it was harder than now.
Yeah.
A time when, I mean, even though, as we had mentioned before, the white male mafia still exists in the publishing world, but you know, back then, there was so much coded language, and how,
ugh,
you know, when I think about that and those women who spoke back then, it's unbelievable.
Absolutely. I mean, the word hysteria itself, you know, it's, you know, when you think about the root words of that, and for sure, you know, I grew up, and I talk about it quite frankly, very frankly, and very often. I think it's important to discuss my own internalized misogyny growing up. And so I think that it took a kind of banshee of a writer to really stir my blood in ways that helped me recognize my own self and to quit denying who I was and what I was in this world as just, you know, a queer Chicana woman who had a child at 17, didn't go to college ever, was homeless for a year, lived in a crack house. I mean, just to understand that it was okay to approach that and to say that without any shame, and to even be, to have the audacity to marvel at your own survival, you know, is such an important thing. And it's what I try to pass on to anyone who will listen, really, is like, you know, you're here right now, and maybe it's even by accident. Maybe you didn't even intend to still be here, but you're here. And so please, please, please be loud. Don't ever shut up. The gatekeepers are all white men. So make your own gate. Build your own castle if you have to. Do what you can, you know, to also provide a platform to others. It's really, I get a big kick out of doing that, out of seeing the quiet one and saying, hey, come here, I got something to tell you, a little whisper in your ear. And the next thing you know, like, they're leaving their abusive partner and they're, they have their hair down and they got a tattoo. And
things are taking off. Okay.
Yes.
We have time for a few more.
Sure. All right. I have a trilogy of poems that are called, that I call in my head the Back to Life poems, and this is the final one. The last time I came back to life, I did it alone, not in bed, where I'd willed myself dead so many years, I became apparition. Not in the bathroom where I fed my body to a hungry blade and cut down my hair with a match. It was not in the arms of the man I tried over and over to amputate, or in the songs of my kind and clever children. No. The last time I came back to life was in the middle of an ordinary day while at the grocery store, when I caught my reflection in the butcher's glass and did not flinch. In January, kin. In January, when nothing could thaw, my son confessed he wished me dead. Then, piled in the center of the attic floor, a most cruel jackpot. Every gift I'd ever given him, a diary of fang and venom. The trees, crippled by ice, stood watch as my son moved slowly down the street like a hearse, then gone. All winter, I wanted to write a poem that did not involve the word ruin. My body, this house, the child who refused to take hold. Such desperate, complicated thefts. Pry my mouth open, find the stench of a final prayer. Dear gods of flesh and instinct, forgive my boy's inherited crimes, the voices that spin his brain into a wooden horse. Grant him a warm home, far away from this body. My blood has never been, will never be, kind. The other children have agreed to forfeit their inheritance. When it comes, we do our best to declare no vacancy. Ignore its rotted knock when, say, my tomato sauce spills upon the tablecloth and my brain responds the only way it is wired to respond, the dizzy spiral of a hypnotist's wheel, hair lifting wicked from my scalp. Quickly, my girls wet the cloth with salt. Quickly, my boy spoons out another dish. Let us pretend for a moment this won't ever end. The relentless machine of us. Let us defy the laws of science and inevitability. Say, we will go on, even as all the poisons of the house reside in me, when madness knows no other name but mine. We will go on.
The poetry of Rachel McKibbins, reading from her book Blood, published by Copper Canyon. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you. Had a great time.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.